Welcome to Agency of the Month, brought to you by the CSC NGEN team on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This month's agency is Navy.
Welcome to the program. We're focusing on personnel at the Navy today. My guest is Juan Garcia, Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs. Mr. Secretary, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us, Francis. Appreciate it.
Where do we stand today with the uniformed force in the Navy, sir?
I think I would answer in two ways. One, the community and the country should know you have never had a more qualified recruit by any objective metric, standardized test score that is ASVAB or AFQT. We've never been here before. Traditional educational background, we've never been here before. Technical savvy, we've never been here before. So the country should feel great about the quality of sailor they're getting. The second piece is, after the longest sustained combat operations in American history, it's a force of sailors and Marines and families that are have undergone a very challenging operational tempo for the last decade. It's deployment after deployment after deployment in many cases. And as I suspect you followed, with the rollout of the new National Defense Strategy, with a focus on the Pacific, but still heavy responsibilities in the Persian Gulf, it's a strategy that focuses on the sea services and that the Navy and the Marine Corps figure prominently.
What is your strategy within the broader strategy to keep that force fresh, to refresh the people that you have, and to bring in new personnel that continue to keep things fresh?
Well, we are determined on both the Navy and the Marine Corps side that despite the budgetary challenges and a drawdown in Iraq and now in Afghanistan, we will not repeat mistakes that that organizations and maybe sister services have made in the past, and that is to cap or shorten or limit our new accessions. We know that creates a whole 5-10 years down the road. So we think we can manage this transition and the shift in strategy while keeping our accessions where they are now.
Where are a couple of the spaces right now, sir, that you are looking for personnel in particular? Obviously, you want quality people at all times, but what areas in the force are you looking to buck up in particular right now?
Sure. The key growth areas, or as we say, the NECs or rates on the Navy side are clearly in the IT world, specifically cyber warfare, ballistic missile defense. You may have followed that we made a commitment to have 4 permanently positioned destroyers in Europe, largely on that mission.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the incredible advances being made in the area of unmanned vehicles. And the Marine Corps, I think I would say the key growth MOSs are also cyber and unmanned vehicles as well.
Mm-hmm. The cyber people that you're recruiting, where are they coming from? What are the skills that they have that they come in? It's interesting. Every time I have a conversation with anybody, uniformed or civilian, anywhere in the government, the criteria for a successful cyber professional seems to be different all over the place.
That's interesting. Well, you know, this is we got to speak beforehand. I know you have a young son.
Mm-hmm.
This is generation. This is the PlayStation generation. They
yeah.
grew up, and so there's an interesting debate about at what level the pilots, if you will, if unmanned vehicles should be at. Does it take a traditional winged aviator who spent $1.5 million in training going through the cycle, or someone who's grown up as part of this generation? Fortunately for us, as we make that assessment, and it'll differ with every unmanned system, we're getting an incredible range and yield of interest from the nation's premier engineering schools to young people with incredible technical savvy who are interested in having this experience, earning a GI Bill before they go on to perhaps one of those engineering schools.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
The idea of serving your country is not necessarily the most popular among young people right now. How are you promoting service in the Navy as not just noble but desirable, a place that someone can build a good career at that age?
I think there's 3 draws that are resulting in us having this unprecedented quality of both accessions, recruiting, and also an unprecedented level of retention. Never been tougher to stay in the Navy or the Marine Corps. And I always say you can break it down into 3 pieces. One is, undeniably, this challenging outside economic environment is having an impact. There's a cadre of young people who undoubtedly would have been swept up by private industry who are now considering military service as a real option. The second piece is, I think, candidly, our compensation package, which may have lagged historically, has caught up to their civilian counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of housing, in terms of salary. The new I believe, historically generous GI Bill, which for the first time is transferable to a spouse or to a child. But the third piece is undeniably, and this is more than anecdotal, I feel it with every unit I get the opportunity to sit down with, this is a generation that has known nothing but war their entire adult lives. Every Marine who stands on yellow footprints, every sailor who raises their right hand and goes to Great Lakes has every reason to believe they'll be sent somewhere sandy or into an incredibly challenging operational tempo in the very near future. And they keep coming. It's, as I said, it's an embarrassment of riches how great a recruit quality we're getting right now.
It's an interesting comment you made. It's never been tougher to stay in the Navy and Marine Corps. Expand on that a little bit, because I think there's an image out in the country, especially, as you say, after a decade or longer of war, that it's probably really difficult to get people to go in and do those jobs. Why is it tougher to stay in than ever before?
Yeah. It's counterintuitive, but I will tell you, on the Navy side, we just went through a really difficult process we called an enlisted retention board, where we ultimately had to ask 3,000 of our sailors to move on and continue their careers largely outside the Navy. And the rationale was, candidly, we had our typical promotion advancement systems were working as designed, but those systems never designed or never forecast this level of retention. 108% in some areas, 130% in some key areas. Folks just aren't getting out. I think it has to do with, again, a challenging economy, a very competitive compensation package for them and their families. And this part of, as challenging as the operational tempo has been, this generation, I'm convinced, a big chunk of it is drawn to arguably the defining events of their generation, their lifetime. The experts tell us that only 1 in 4 17 to 24-year-old Americans are physically, morally, legally qualified to serve in uniform. We hear so much about a generation that's soft, that's apathetic, that's not physically fit, that grew up playing video games on the couch. That's not the candidates we're getting. That's not the candidates we're getting. The competition has never been more intense to stay in. And we went through that enlisted retention board. And as difficult as it was, we think it's going to open up advancement and retention opportunities for a lot of great sailors and their families.
What will your force look like 5 years from now based on the goals that you've outlined in the strategy? How will it look different then than it does today?
Well, the good news on the Navy side is that, again, this is counterintuitive. Despite a decades-long period of combat, Navy end strength has actually gone down. The Navy, I think more so than its sister services, manpower and end strength ultimately is a function of force structure. That is, for a given number of carriers and strike groups requires is almost a formula to the number of officers and sailors you'll need with that. As we become more efficient in our systems, we've needed fewer personnel. I think the Navy end strength number is pretty much where it's at right now. We'll continue to balance it, hone it. We constantly assess to make sure we've got the right specialties and the right sailor in the right place at the right time. The Marine Corps, on the other hand, is, as you probably know, built up dramatically after 9/11, north of 20,000 Marines. And so there was always a belief that that when major combat operations ended, it would come back down. And if you've had a chance to follow the latest budget projections, the Marine Corps, by the end of 2016, fiscal 2016, will be 20,000 Marines smaller. But it's important to note that'll still be more a larger Marine Corps than we had on 9/11, for example.
What do you see differently when you're on duty in the reserve than you see in your chair at the Pentagon every day?
I think you get you know, it's impossible in a PowerPoint presentation to capture daily life for sailors and Marines. And, you know, the operational tempo that, you know, that I knew as a junior officer kind of between the Cold War, but pre 9/11, with, I don't want to say unlimited resources, but it was a robust time for defense. It's so different than, the pace we're expecting from our families, our sailors and our Marines right now. You know, if you're a young Marine now, let's say you're at your 10-year mark, you've likely seen 3-4 deployments. the old days of a carrier coming in, a six-month cruise, and then having 18 months to regroup, recharge, retrain, and go back to the training cycle, is all too often not the case anymore. You may have followed some news earlier or last month when the USS Bataan came home from a 10-and-a-half-month cruise.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a toll on families,
yeah,
and sailors and young kids as well.
Mm-hmm. Juan Garcia is my guest. He's Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Agency of the Month on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
CSC stands ready to partner with the Department of Navy on Next Generation Enterprise Network to achieve a fully integrated naval networking environment. The world-class CSC team, including Harris, General Dynamics IT, and Verizon, has the experience to deliver innovative networking solutions that enhance performance, improve security, and cut costs to affordably meet evolving needs of sailors and Marines today and for years to come. Visit NGenReady.com for more information. That's NGenReady.com.
Thanks for listening to Agency of the Month on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM for the month of March. We're focused on the United States Navy. My guest today is Juan Garcia, Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs. Mr. Secretary, a short time ago, the Navy, you and Secretary Mabus introduced an initiative where you will be installing breathalyzers on ships across the Navy. Talk about the genesis of that, what drove that decision, and how you're going to implement that.
Sure. Thanks for asking, Francis. As you know, the Navy and the Marine Corps are a reflection of the larger society, and as we took a step back after a decade of combat and looking towards a new national defense strategy, which will center on the Navy and Marine Corps, we realized that a large chunk of our most pressing personnel problems, as our societies, suicide, sexual assault, domestic violence, personal safety, DUIs, and alcohol abuse, had a lone common denominator, and that's the misuse of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to limit the responsible use of alcohol, but when we see a strain, a clear common denominator, we felt like it was irresponsible not to address it. So we took a step back and wrestled with how to change a culture. It's interesting. Back in 1980, a DOD survey suggested that upwards of a quarter of U.S. military personnel had had an illicit drug within their body in the previous 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
In 81 is the horrific mishap on the USS Nimitz that took 14 sailors, 6 aircraft, $50 million. And the investigators determined that illicit drug use was a factor. The following year, the Navy started random urinalysis. Testing refined. And by the end of that decade, that north of 25% figure was under 3%. Today, across the Navy and Marine Corps, we do about 160,000 random urine analysis a year, 100,000 on the Navy side, about 60,000 on the Marine Corps. And the rate of positive pops, if you will, is now 0.3%, essentially statistically negligible, a complete culture change.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked for something similar with the misuse of alcohol. So the new initiative, part of our 21st Century Sailor and Marine program, is that sailors coming to work, not coming back from liberty to rest on the ship, not leaving work, not off on their liberty time, but coming to work at a time we have the most advanced and technical gear in the history of the department. Every duty section will be subject to breath analysis for alcohol. And the crew coming to work will randomly be tested as well. We piloted this program up at SubPAC, our submarine force up in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And we found was a 45% drop in alcohol-related incidents. Our intention, unlike the drug piece, is that a positive test will not be punitive or legal in nature, but to be a guide, a training tool, an effort for senior leadership to recognize trends and offer the counseling, the information, the resources needed so that misuse doesn't evolve into a career debilitating or potentially life debilitating incident down the road. And this way we hope to address that range of personnel problems across the board.
Had an interesting conversation with a former Navy person, a uniformed gentleman, and I said, don't you think that this will aggravate people who are in the force? And he said, on the contrary, I think people will be happy to know that the man or woman next to them is fully capable of doing whatever job needs to be done, especially in an environment where your life could depend on the person that's next to you, either to the left or right.
It's a great point, and that's how it's been received largely across the fleet. Our Navy today, every submarine is nuclear-powered, every carrier is nuclear-powered. It's the most advanced technical Navy we've ever had. And we need every sailor and Marine to come to work at the top of their game.
Mm-hmm. The overall personnel staffing is, as we talked about strategy earlier, will be directed more toward the Pacific Rim and toward the Middle East. What kind of preparations, what kind of accommodations do you need to make to be able to redirect your force in that way?
You may have read about current planning to focus marine rotations and personnel throughout the Pacific. Darwin, Australia, a permanent rotation for the first time. And we're still working through the appropriate laydown for Japan and Guam. But the marine presence west of the international dateline will be robust.
Mm-hmm.
And the Navy focus, we've always kept a strike group in Japan. That's why we were able to respond so quickly to the disaster in Fukushima with Operation Tomodachi. You'll remember last year.
Yes.
And we'll focus resources to that side of the world in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. What is it like to go into an environment, as you mentioned, we've never had a base in the Australia area before. You go in there pretty much starting from scratch. We have the benefit, obviously, of good diplomatic relations with Australia. But staking out potential place to locate a base, all of those kinds of things, keeping the personnel element of that in mind.
Right. Well, the Aussies have been great and loyal allies for a long time. It's routine to bring our carriers through there as port calls en route to that part of the world. They've been partners in exercises as long as I can remember. For the marine rotation that'll go through Darwin up in the northwest part of the continent there, the intention is not to build a permanent base, but to work with the Aussie allies in their facility at Darwin and move Marines through on a roughly 6-month basis and enhance that presence.
Mm-hmm.
And the Aussies welcomed it and, in fact, initiated it in many ways.
Mm-hmm. The overall force stands at how many right now?
The Navy end strength as we speak is about 322,000.
And the overall number that you expect to be in when the strategy that came out in December is fully deployed is about what?
We think the Navy, after downsizing for the last decade, we're at the number we need to support our current force.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the budget picture should change or the unthinkable, like sequestration happens, we'll rethink that. But right now, we've got our end strength where we want it. The challenge for us and what we're assessing every day is ensuring we've got the right balance, the right sailor, the right place, the right time. Marine end strength, as we had a chance to discuss briefly, after having built up dramatically for 9/11, as we wrap up in Iraq, ramp down in Afghanistan, will come down about 20,000. But again, and this is the key point, we'll still be larger than it was on 9/11.
Now, as you know, my guest on this program last week was your counterpart, Secretary Commons, and we talked about the financial implications if sequestration happens. Where do you begin the process in the event that January 2013 rolls around, nothing's been done, sequestration takes place? Where do you begin the process of trying to analyze where you go from here?
Well, I guess you've hit on the exact point that makes the suggestion or the hovering possibility of sequestration just so daunting. The Navy builds end strength based on strategy and infrastructure. That is, the number of ships, squadrons, carriers, submarines drives our personnel. And the mechanics of sequestration require across-the-board cuts. It just doesn't lend itself to a strategy. You can't buy half a carrier, for
mm-hmm.
example. So we think we're at the end strength we need to support the strategy we have and to do it well. So sequestration will require us fundamentally rethinking that strategy.
Maybe we can step back another layer from that, because fundamentally rethinking a strategy that you just finished, I can only imagine must be daunting on the one hand, frustrating on the other hand, to essentially redo several years of work.
Redo several years of work, take a huge chunk of manpower and talent and trained personnel off their current focus of executing, and instead to revisit years of planning.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't make sense, and it's bad for the department.
When you interact with people on the Hill, talk about the response that you get when you try to make that case as an advocate for the men and women in uniform.
Well, I, I, as you know, the no one wants sequestration, and it was designed as a as an unthinkable hammer to force agreement. So we'll testify in the Hill later this month. Our colleagues have been up there already, and everyone knows their message has been without exception that this is. This will require fundamental rethinking strategy. It's bad for the department. It's bad for the Department of Defense. It's bad for national defense. And we've yet to cross paths, I think, with a member who supports sequestration. It's just trying to find a way to avoid it.
Mr. Secretary, I appreciate your time today. We just have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to hear some about some other initiatives that you're working on or success stories that you're having as far as being able to keep the men and women that you have in uniform and in the reserves engaged in what they're doing. You've talked about the level of success that you're having doing that, that you're literally having to ask people to leave instead of trying to get them to stay. But talk about specifically some of the things that you're doing to make sure that some of the areas where you really do need to keep people, you're able to do that.
I'm glad to. I mentioned before this 21st Century Sailor and Marine Initiative, and a couple of key components that I'd love to emphasize are pieces like inclusion. We know that we have more women, for example, serving in the Navy and the Marine Corps than we've ever had before, but our challenge is still to retain those highly trained personnel, especially as they consider starting and raising families against the backdrop of our challenging operational tempo. So part of that 21st Century Sailor and Marine Initiative is offering a range of programs that we think will allow us to keep those highly trained individuals and not have that experience of walk out the door even though they'd like to stay.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, we have a 12-month operational deferment for new mothers who will continue to serve, bring their talent and their experience, but be able to come home every night to stay bond with a new child. We have a program called the Career Intermission Pilot where male and female sailors can apply to transition in what we call the IRR for up to 3 years to raise a young family, to tend to an ill relative, maybe take advantage of a unique business opportunity or a unique educational opportunity. They'll still maintain their exchange and commissary benefits, their health care benefits. In fact, they're entitled to a move within the continental U.S. to a destination of their choice. They'll even get a portion of their salary, a stipend. In exchange, we'll ask for a 2-year commitment for every year they spent in the IRR, and we reap the benefit of maintaining that talent and that experience. We also know that against that challenging operational tempo, often a piece that slides out is personal fitness and physical fitness. So we're focused on providing our sailors and Marines with the best training options and best fueling options that they've ever had. We call Fuel to Fight our program to have the healthiest food options in every galley, chow hall, mess hall, wardroom in the fleet. No one's forcing a sailor or a Marine to eat their broccoli, but you're going to be educated on your best options. You're going to have those best options available.
Mm-hmm.
We started a program called NOFS, Navy Operational Fuel and Fitnessing Standards, so that if you're on a submarine that doesn't have a gym, or a small boy, a small ship that doesn't have a gym, or in an expeditionary setting in Afghanistan without a gym, we've got a series of exercises you can download on your phone to maintain a peak physical fitness in any setting.
Mm-hmm.
A slew of operational stress control programs designed to ensure we're providing the tools and the mechanisms for sailors and Marines in this challenging time to have the tools they need to succeed and excel. I think it's going to be positive.
Mr. Secretary, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thanks for the opportunity and your interest. Appreciate it.
Juan Garcia is Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs. The Navy is our focus on Agency of the Month this month, and you can hear all of our programs at federalnewsradio.com. Search term Agency of the Month. Thanks very much for listening.
You've been listening to Agency of the Month, brought to you by the CSC NGEN team on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Search Navy. Agency of the Month, Thursday mornings at 10 AM, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Your source for federal news now.